Well, it's great to be invited to come all this way. Thank you very much. It's been an amazing day, actually. I've been reminded of a whole lot of things. I've learned a whole lot of things, and I realise how much I still have to learn about this very interesting, fascinating, curious and complex man. So I hope you're not too tired being at the end of the day, but I'm going to read you a paper that I'm hoping will be half an hour and not too dense for you at this time of day. So, as a stage designer and theatre architect, my research, teaching and creative work concerns the intersection between space and performance. By focusing on the dynamics of performance space specifically, I can investigate spatial performativity generally. That is, how space itself performs as an active and influential system of forces, not only in the theatre, but also in our daily lives. I see the theatre as a place where various worlds emerge, fuse, collide, and jostle for the attention of a collective body of spectators. These worlds range from the palpably real to the inconceivably fantastic, from the ancient past to the unimagined future. For millennia, theatre has provided the site where gods and ghosts are called to join the living. And those living are not only the players upon the stage, but the community of public gathered to witness the event in which objects, setting, architecture, light, sound, and garments also perform. However, this overarching performativity is rarely considered or discussed in theatre discourse, where the expressive human performer remains central. In his critical introduction to the book Performance, Marvin Carlson parenthetically notes, even in the theatre we do not speak of how well the scenery or costumes performed, close bracket. Well, it's high time we do speak of how design elements not only actively extend the human body, the performing body, but also perform without and in spite of the human body. This reinforces Jiří Veltruský's claim that even a lifeless object may be perceived as a performing subject, and a live human being may be perceived as an element completely without will. And no one knew this better than Edward Gordon Craig, who called for the uber-marionette to replace the actor, challenging the primacy of the performer in order to give all elements equal value within his revolutionary scene. Craig was a consummate performance designer as opposed to stage, scene or theatre designer. He was not designing some elements for performance, but considering all elements as performance. Craig understood that places and things precede action as action in order to orchestrate them as elements in motion that play not only on the eye but also on the senses and the psyche of the most important and unpredictable element in the event, the audience. There's much to be said on Craig's understanding of spatial performativity, but in this short lecture I'll confine my argument to his radical understanding of the stage as a site that negotiates between the lived world and the virtuality of the imagination, between the static spectator and the mobility of audience perception, between the abstract void of modernism and the materiality of its architecture, between a suspended spatio-temporal realm and the multiplicitous reality in perpetual motion. This interstitial zone of in-betweenness navigates a seeming paradox in his discourse between the void, here referred to as absolute space, and his scene, which I call an archetypal architecture. Yet the country that lies between is the performance landscape, a unified and mobile spatial composition of theatrical elements which resist specificity of place and containment within the frame. The best way to convey this notion of what I call a universal performance landscape is to first discuss how it pertains to Craig's creative thinking and then how it has influenced my own design work, which utilizes the live event as a means of negotiating between theatre architecture and stage design. And earlier we had a reference to the practitioner theorist, which I guess is how I really frame myself. So to begin, we're all aware of the florid language adopted by Craig, which seems rather pompous and old-fashioned in this day and age, and I suspect it was rather pompous and old-fashioned in his day and age. Yet perhaps in the most purple of his prose lies a claim that marks a significant moment in the history of modern stage space and its design, a moment referred to by Craig as the beginning, the birth. In 1907, he placed some notes in the back of his copy of Serlio's 1545 treatise, Architectura, which read, "As I write, it's not easy to refrain from singing. The moment is the most lively, the most hallowed in all my life, for in a few minutes I shall have given birth to that which has for a long while been preparing far back before I was born, and all during my life. And now I am the one selected to this honour and am amongst the creators." This excerpt reads like the Virgin Mary's post-Annunciation song of praise, heralding the arrival of a Messiah created through immaculate conception. However, in this case, the writer, asserting himself simultaneously as mother, father, and divine messenger, was announcing a progeny which was strange fruit indeed. Actually, after today, I feel like we could do psychoanalysis and Edward Gordon Craig as a symposium. Craig's moment was marking the arrival of a new performance space, further outlined by... So the strange fruit indeed. Craig's moment was marking the arrival of a new performance space, further outlined by him in an article called Motion. He describes a vast, empty square of space out of which emerges life in the form of atoms stirring and rising in the infinite gloom, appearing, multiplying, and disappearing. This was the beginning of Craig's scene, a spatial dramaturgy based on the art of movement. Out of his dark, silent, and motionless ether, objects, bodies, and architectonic forms are materialized and suspended. And yet this compelling and mystical space is also terrifying as it summons the abyss that had opened up in the new century, which avant-garde artists were attempting to confront in poetry, painting, and on the stage. Emerging from the late 19th century symbolist movement, Craig's rhythmic and abstract scene developed into a dynamic and tectonic no man's land, which found expression in the scenographic landscapes proposed by both him and his Swiss contemporary, Adolf Appia. And I will refer to this space as absolute space. Absolute space exemplifies the symbolist desire for theatre to provide a secular temple set apart from daily life and is much more than a radically simplified stage. The term is taken from French philosopher Henri Lefebvre's influential treatise, The Production of Space, in which he defines absolute space as embodying an antagonism between full and empty. Associated with the natural world and the ancient sanctuary, this archaic space is a realm that consecrates and concentrates, an empty space to be filled up and activated. As Lefebvre writes, it has no place because it embodies all places and has a strictly symbolic existence. Its alignment with both the temple and nature encapsulated the symbolist desire to sacralize the site of performance. It would be easy to assume that Craig's empty space presaged the black box theatre as the definitive empty space of theatrical reproduction. The black box came to represent both experimental theatre and veiled modernist stage in the second half of the 20th century. Built as an instrumentalized theatrical void that suspends notions of time and space, the black box negates the object of architecture itself and presents a symbolic location cut off from the concrete world, complemented by its visual arts counterpart, the White Cube Gallery. It has sought to construct emptiness, silence, and lack through an apparent dematerialization of form, facilitated by the simple absence of color. For Craig and his symbolist predecessors, the empty space is not simply a stripping bare to make way for innumerable fabricated worlds, but a means of expressing and facing the breach that had opened up toward the end of the 19th century. His scene gradually became more architectonic. proposing a new architectural monumentality which is far from the hermetically sealed black box. Predicated on movement, openness, and flexibility, architecture and scenography are folded into universal landscapes which presage, as the presentation before me so well illustrated, the abstract spaces of the modern movement, and infuse them with performative qualities that challenge their static rationality. Craig's architectonic scene was inspired by two diagrams in Serlio's Architectura, and that's the book where he put those notes about giving birth to a new theatre. And in this book, Serlio's forms were extruded orthogonal forms from a grid in a two-point perspective. The three-dimensional spatial grid could provide a matrix for the appearance and disappearance of endless permutations of monochromatic forms. However, it was the rhythmic fluctuations of light and movement that would enliven the otherwise mechanical and static forms of a regimented architecture to create a space that negotiated between gravity and flight, architecture and flesh, geometric matrix and fluctuating form. Serlio's gridded structures formed the rational basis for Craig's scene, created from a series of forms that could be lowered and raised to varying levels. However, it was in a live performer that Craig found inspiration for his dancing architectonics, someone who I believe is incredibly influential, even though he may have dismissed her, as the first talk this morning suggested. In 1905, Craig met the revolutionary American dancer Isadora Duncan, with whom he had a creative and romantic involvement for many years. In contrast with the marionette whose freedom from the burden of gravity he so highly valued, Duncan's body was grounded. Her movements were fluid, natural, and rhythmic, while also light and flexible. Craig's choreographic orchestration of architecture, body, and light within an expressive mobile system set space in constant motion, challenging the authority of static perspectival scenery. However, the movement could be extremely subtle, inspired by Duncan, who was capable of creating vibratile stillness. Form and atmosphere could be imperceptibly manipulated by this scenic orchestration. Perhaps something that with the interactive downstairs is not so clear. It might be quite good to have somebody there that can really show how, in terms of lighting design, we can get very, very subtle changes and shifts. The scenographic performativity of Craig's scene constructs and deconstructs an other world on stage through elements that fold and unfold from the darkness at varying rates. Craig replaced the representational pictorial scene with a presentational architectonic scene in order to render scenography what he called a genuine thing, a work of architecture. Through a process of distillation, he established his simplified stage, a single performance environment that evokes a multiplicity of locales, from slum to palace, from heaven to hell, by a careful orchestration of well-chosen objects, lighting, and the movement of performers. Craig searched for essential form by identifying common and persisting features in 250 models of historic and international architecture. He said, "I wish to reduce scene to its essentials, and I found it reduced itself. I then added mobility to it." Conforming to the spirit of incessant change, Craig's archetypal scene combines the apparently timeless and stable elements of architecture with the flux of modernity and the requirements of theatrical production. Yet neither the process nor the product is simple. Craig's rigorous process of analysis and rejection eventually leads beyond the mutable architectonics of his scenographic screens and architectonic scenes to an archetypal architecture illustrated in his design proposals for the St. Matthew Passion, which occupied him for many years and was never realized in built form. He originally intended his screens to be inserted into a church as a permanent scenic system, but soon realised that this design could be transformed into the permanent architecture of an epic theatre, especially erected for annual festival performances of the Oratorio, which he would personally orchestrate. Moving from infinite permutations of simplified forms, Craig advocated a single structural setting capable of presenting many places. Based on the small Italian Romanesque church in Giornico, which Craig sketched in 1910, the design for the St. Matthew Passion developed into a complex multi-level structure of stairways, bridges, platforms and receding arches beyond which lay a limitless field of light. This permanent unified architectural setting strengthened Craig's fundamental rejection of the pictorial scene and was consistent with his desire to recover architecture as the primary source, as Chris mentioned, of the theatrical setting. In the second preface of Towards a New Theatre, he wrote, "Once upon a time, stage scenery was architecture. A little time later, it became imitation architecture. Still later, it became imitation artificial architecture." As a return to architecture, Craig's St. Matthew Passion established a universal performance landscape for the Oratorio in which the designer had distilled the multiple spatialities of the work into a complex performative environment that worked with an audience's imagination to complete the spaces it evoked. W.B. Yeats maintained that Craig created an ideal country where everything was possible, even speaking in verse or in music, or the expression of the whole of life in a dance. This notion of a placeless, timeless site which obeys location and exceeds borders resists the fixity and even the site-specific nature of the architecture itself. Craig's performance landscapes were ideal countries, universal to place and time, and presaging the utopias of the modern movement. Yet as sacred secular spaces, they were also cast adrift within the imagination of those occupying the performances for a limited time. Like Sir Thomas More's original utopia, these non-existent island spaces represent an idea, an ideal, considered in itself absolutely, absolute space, is located nowhere. It has no place because it embodies all places and has a strictly symbolic existence. As an architectural scene, the performance landscape integrates the existing environment with the fictive space of performance, and it is this amalgamation that my own work has sought for the last 15 years in which I have developed the notion of a performance landscape. I tend to enlist the existing architecture as a dynamic player, working with its features in order to make a statement about the performance as a contemporary event, to bring the then there with the now here, simultaneously presencing the virtual and the actual by acknowledging a productive architecture hidden in the shadows. This began with attempts to deny the neutrality of the black box venue within which I was originally working. In Henry VIII, A Sexual Sermon, I revealed all the flaws in the blackened building by highlighting each scuff, scratch, and mark with white paint. I then applied layers of flaking black paper to the walls, which were brushed with white, to turn it into a blistering, sweating surface that referenced the corrupt regime of Henry VIII, a syphilitic king who carved a smooth white swathe through the dark, diseased space in which the audience sat, like members of his court, reminding us that, as onlookers, we're always complicit with history's events. In Ngā Tanga Tatoa, the warrior people, a bicultural reworking of Ibsen's The Vikings at Helgoland, I referenced the black walls as those of the marae, which is a Maori meeting house, which the lead character, Rongomai, burns down in the final act before killing her lover, Tane Atua, as a vengeance for her father's murder. The audience inhabits the burnt-out space heaped with black iron sand as a community revisiting the site of tragedy. Lifting the lighting grid into the rafters, I connected black posts to the trusses, which were placed between the spectators and action, referencing and binding both playhouse and meeting house. The environment also alluded to the landscape paintings of Colin McCann, who maintained that New Zealand's brutality comes from being, quote, a landscape with too few lovers, unquote. This dark landscape is employed in Fire Cairo, Mother Hundred Eater, another bicultural working of a classic, in this case Brecht's Mother Courage, where a red seam traces over the black walls and obscured windows, covered in Maori proverbs and tattered circus posters. Setting this production in the New Zealand land wars of the mid-19th century also allowed me to refer to the early theatres of that colonial era, which were smoky, carnivalesque beer halls, in this case filled with mud and bifurcated by a makeshift road of timber planks, either side of which sat the spectators. In these productions, I denied the black box its role as an immaterial architecture of the void, but rather revealed it as a spatial vortex that was visceral, contaminated, and distinctly material. Each production allowed me to employ the black box's hidden materiality to give presence to an other performance place, the corrupt court, the burnt marae, and the shadowy beer hall. In 2003, I designed the central exhibit for the Prague Quadrennial, referred to as a performance landscape for the senses, which aimed to exhibit performance design through action rather than represent it with artifacts. This sino-architecture, sited in the middle hall of Prague's industrial palace, provided an abstract landscape upon which international artists negotiated spectators and each other. Five towers, each one dedicated to one of the senses, were embedded in an undulating landscape of timber planks. And in this three-dimensional labyrinth, the public encountered multiple sites of performance. During the process, I was introduced to the choreographer, Dr. Carol Brown, who curated the Tower of Touch, which we approached as an anatomical theatre of technological touch. And in this performance, Carol completed the performance that she did as a site-specific work on this installation with a tango where everybody ended up dancing together and touching each other. So we moved from technological touch to visceral touch, human touch. Carol and I have been working on a number of movement architecture projects, which we refer to as research in motion. These include Hurtopia, a site-specific performance in and around the Duncan Dance Research Centre in Athens, adapted from a curious stone structure erected by Isadora's brother Raymond in 1903 as a temple to her art. By utilising the simple elements of stone, mirrors and red tape, we gave everyday spaces a mythical dimension. The audience was led through a number of exterior and interior sites, in a performance that concluded in a courtyard surrounded by apartment buildings, on top of which dancers moved, ecstatically spreading the stage out into the city itself. In 2006, we were commissioned by the New Zealand International Arts Festival to create a new work, which was provoked by the 2002 Moscow theatre siege, where terror literally took the stage and women's bodies strapped with bomb belts were co-opted as weapons. Devised between dancer, choreographer and designer architect, Arero Stone is subtitled A Solo in a Performance Landscape. This dynamic environment that combines the existing architecture, theatre architecture, with abstract interventions is designed to shift the stage into an enigmatic, mythic realm. Central to the project is the myth of Niobe, a woman grieving for her lost children who is transformed into a weeping stone in the landscape and wears away over time. This notion of women metamorphosized and dematerialized through grief is danced on the abstract architectural setting that incorporates, resists, reflects, and refracts the woman's body, which is itself a shapeshifter. The performance landscape referred to memorial architecture in order to shift the stage environment into a mythic realm. Soundings Theatre is treated as a site-specific environment for performance, exposing the walls and technology of the stage and referencing the timber panelling of the auditorium. Revealed as a machine for transformation, the existing architecture is folded in with the new design interventions composed of monumental forms placed on a cartographer's grid of reflective crosses. A shadowy tomb in the concrete wall, a black vessel containing white stones, a dark mirror hovering over a pool of water. Stagehouse and architectonic setting merge into a single performance landscape stitched together by the red dash of a horizon line. Arero means tongue in Māori, and the stone tongue is the speaking landscape upon which the solo dancer performs an archaeology of buried voices. An entombed Sybil endures as her body disappears. Niobe turns to stone in mourning for her dead children. The women of Bellstone are petrified as punishment for dancing on the Sabbath. She is mother, lover, widow, supplicant, siren, priestess, victim, and assailant, fleshy, phantasmatic, inscrutable, and mercurial. The performance concludes with an ecstatic figure moving in the water, her floating image doubled in the mirror overhead. Edward Gordon Craig's process of distillation created environments that resist clear identification with any one site. This allows the location to shift from interior to exterior, from nature to built form, from concrete to imaginary. Refusing containment by the frame, his rhythmic scenes extended spatiality in keeping with Gertrude Stein's 1935 allusion to a play as a landscape, simultaneously in movement and stasis, a relationship among things where no one element is the central focus. Craig sought a symbiosis between performance elements, light, space, sound, set, body, object, in which they fluctuate in their powers but unite in their effect. His performance landscapes, which refuted the scenic background in favour of a set of environmental conditions, became dynamic players that supported, provoked, and at times resisted the performer. Abstract, architectural, elemental, and atmospheric, these architectonic fields evoked a multitude of places with an active force that challenged the absolute centrality of the live performer and celebrated the active and dynamic role of design and designer.